This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Carly Huckles. Colorado electric utilities are trying out new technology to cut down their carbon emissions, but the transition isn't exactly smooth sailing. We'll hear more about the long road to achieving zero carbon.
There's a little more than a week left in the legislative session, and Colorado lawmakers are scrambling to get several hundred bills over the finish line. We'll get an update on that. Plus, chronic wasting disease is being called a crisis, a state of emergency, and the stuff of a horror movie.
This is a kind of a worst-case nightmare.
But what is it, and how concerned should we be?
We'll look into that. Plus, we hear from Howie Moshevitz about why movies are still best seen on the big screen.
But first, state lawmakers are dropping an effort to approve a paid family leave program this year. Instead, the Democratic sponsors want to create a task force to study the issue and then make recommendations next year.
Taxes on cigarettes, e-cigs, and other nicotine products could go up significantly in Colorado. A bill would ask voters to decide whether to raise the tax on a pack of cigarettes from 84 cents to $2.59.
The sole finalist for the University of Colorado system president spent the week touring the college's four campuses. Mark Kennedy is facing criticism over his conservative voting record in Congress, as well as budget cuts he made as president of the University of North Dakota. Questions about diversity and inclusion dominated the second forum that was at the campus at Colorado Springs. Kennedy called himself a champion of the LGBTQ community and asked the audience to consider his record at UND.
We never had a dedicated staff to the LGBTQI plus community until I got there. We added that staff person. We added programming.
Since his selection was announced earlier this month, students, faculty, and alumni have come out against Kennedy. But the CU Board of Regents says his experience in business, politics, and higher education make him a great choice.
There are a lot of unanswered questions surrounding the young Florida woman who caused alarm and hundreds of school closures leading up to last week's 20th anniversary of the Columbine shooting. Sol Pais was found dead from an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound.
One question we set out to answer is how the 18-year-old could legally purchase a gun on the same day she arrived in Colorado. KUNC's Lee Patterson sat down with Kyra Buckley to talk through some answers to that question.
So in Colorado, you have to be 18 to buy a long gun, so a shotgun or a rifle, and there's no waiting period per se. But here's the thing. She was from Florida, and under federal law, an out-of-state gun purchase has to be legal in both the state where that purchase is taking place and the state where the buyer is from. In Florida, the age to buy a long gun is 21. That law actually changed last year after the Parkland school shooting. This young woman, as you mentioned, was 18 years old.
And it's up to gun shops to keep track of laws and law changes in other states?
It is. And actually, when you go to buy a gun, you have to fill out some paperwork. And right there on page 3, it basically says that the seller of the firearm should know the applicable state laws in both the seller's and the buyer's states. Now, it's difficult to get gun shops to talk about this issue, but Jacqueline Clark, she's the owner of a Bristlecone Shooting in Lakewood. She described her experience with out-of-state purchases in the 5 years since that store has been opened.
We don't have much experience at all. They're extremely rare, and even more rare when it gets called into question the laws in the other states. We've never actually dealt with a situation where somebody is between 18 and 21 or coming from a state with some recently changed gun laws.
Clark said that they actually almost had one of these sales recently. Someone under the age of 21 came in. They were from out of state, but they suspected that this was actually a straw purchase, meaning someone who was coming in to buy a firearm for someone else who wouldn't be legally allowed to do so.
So we never even got to the finish line, but that would have been the first one that I have record of where we would have had to really figure out how to handle procedurally a sale like that.
The ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, it's the federal body that oversees guns. It's required to help these federally licensed firearms dealers stay on top of this stuff. It provides an updated compilation of state laws to dealers every year. But if you go on ATF's website right now and you click on Florida, it says at the top of the page that those Florida statutes are up to date through the end of the 2016 legislative session. And that was before the law changed, raising the age limit.
So what happens next?
The FBI investigation into what happened is ongoing. And while the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, that's the body responsible for background checks here, said that there were no red flags in her background check, they do understand the concerns around the issue and, quote, have already considered ways to strengthen this process. CBI says it's currently working with a vendor to develop different ways to assist firearms dealers in reviewing these state laws before the actual background check request is submitted.
Lee, thanks for looking into this.
You're welcome, Kyra.
Colorado lawmakers are running out of time to pass more than 300 bills before the end of the legislative session on May 3rd. About 20 of them are bills aimed at improving health care and lowering insurance costs. KUNC Scott Franz has more.
Just over 3 weeks ago, Governor Jared Polis stood in front of one of Denver's biggest hospitals and made a long list of promises about changing health care.
Immediate relief to Coloradans who are forced to pay too much for health care, and longer-term systemic savings, and the longer-term rewarding preventative care.
It's part of a 13-step roadmap, the governor says, will ultimately cut premiums. He's even started a new government office to focus on the issue.
The Office of Saving People Money on Health Care will form the beating heart of our efforts to reduce patient costs for hospital stays and expenses, improve price transparency, lower the cost of prescription drugs, make health care more affordable.
So after hitting his first 100 days in office, just how much traction has the Polis agenda gotten? Here's his take.
I don't know if every single part of that roadmap will reach our desk this year, but I'm very optimistic we will get as much as we can bite off and work on done, and we'll have our authority to move forward in saving people money on health care.
And here's Allie Morgan's view of things.
Very few bills that we have tracked this year that we think are super consequential have already been signed by the governor.
Morgan follows the legislature for the Colorado Health Institute, a nonpartisan research group. She says it could still be a very consequential session for healthcare policy, but
are they just going to run out of time for some of these bigger, more expensive, more complicated proposals to have the kind of debate they need in order to pass them? I don't know if that will happen, but I wouldn't be surprised if we get to the end of the session and there are a few bills, especially with big fiscal notes, where they just feel like they need more time.
Including a measure to establish a state-backed reinsurance program. If approved, the state would spend about $120 million next year to help cover some of the biggest hospital bills for people using the insurance marketplace. Supporters say it could decrease premiums on the Western Slope by as much as 40%. But lawmakers are having difficulty securing federal money for the program.
The fight with the reinsurance bill has really been how to cover the state's share of that, and a fight between hospitals and insurance carriers over who should bear the brunt.
But there has been some traction on Polis's agenda. He signed a bill requiring hospitals to be more transparent about their costs and billing. And lawmakers have approved bills to promote health insurance cooperatives and study a state-backed insurance option.
And I think that's going to be a great innovative step that we can take.
Democratic Representative Dylan Roberts of Avon is sponsoring the public insurance option. His constituents face some of the highest insurance costs in the country.
We can have more competition and more choice for consumers in Colorado. Will particularly help the Western Slope and the Eastern Plains, but it'll be an option that's available to the whole state and give people a more affordable option.
Roberts called this session historic for healthcare policy, but he's also trying to manage expectations.
It's not a one-session issue. We know when we get back here next January, we're going to be working on healthcare as well.
Allie Morgan at the Colorado Health Institute is also taking the long view, but she also thinks having Democrats in charge of both the House and Senate creates its own challenges with healthcare legislation.
Anytime that you have one party in control of a legislature like this, you start to see more internal dynamics and conflicts playing out. They're having to do a lot of negotiating among themselves to come to agreement on bills that then actually have a chance of passing this year.
And she says things may be harder next session, when many lawmakers might be less willing to support controversial bills during an election year. Morgan says Governor Polis is in a better position to influence healthcare policy because he's just starting his term. I'm Scott Franz at the State Capitol.
There are two words causing a lot of stir in Colorado's energy industry right now: zero carbon. Electric utilities that serve Denver, Fort Collins, and other communities have pledged in the coming decades to shed coal and natural gas in favor of cleaner sources like wind and solar. But as KUNC's Matt Bloom reports, the road ahead won't be easy.
About one-third of Colorado's carbon dioxide emissions come from large electric utilities, companies like Xcel Energy, Platte River Power Authority, and Black Hills. But not for long. The cost of using cleaner energy sources is falling fast.
Each one of these boxes, and perhaps you can help me describe it, it's kind of a big
refrigerator.
Big refrigerator.
Jerry Maritza works for United Power. The Northern Colorado utility recently purchased 80 lithium-ion batteries from Tesla. Yeah, Elon Musk's Tesla. The sleek white containers were put into two rows just off a frontage road near I-25 in Longmont. They store the energy produced from nearby wind and solar farms.
Each of these big refrigerators is about 50 kW of battery.
Kilowatts,
and it'll last 4 hours.
When fully charged, the batteries can provide electricity to about 1,000 homes. But that's a very small portion of United Power's customers. Maritza says the company still has some important questions to answer before they can scale it up.
How do they act on a cold day? How do they act on a hot day? Well, the best way, instead of reading the brochure that Tesla hands out, is to actually have one.
Right now, there's a lot of trial and error that must happen before getting to zero carbon. There's also a lot of waiting around.
We're setting a goal for 2050 to be completely carbon free.
This is Xcel Energy President Ben Folk in Denver last December. In a speech announcing the effort, he says it outright. Technologies like longer-lasting batteries, smaller nuclear reactors, and machines that can capture carbon aren't on the marketplace yet. But
just look at what we've done in the last 10 years. Today, we are investing in large wind and solar projects that are 70, if not 80% less expensive than they were just a decade ago.
While utilities like Xcel are betting that big innovations will happen over the next few years, Colorado lawmakers are trying to speed up that process.
I think they are achievable and supportable and scientifically based.
Casey Becker is the Democratic Speaker of the House. She's sponsoring a climate action bill that proposes writing zero carbon goals into state statute.
This bill will absolutely drive innovation and actually grow businesses and I think help the economy as Colorado continues to attract those businesses and those businesses help our utilities figure out how do we help reduce air pollution? How do we help reduce carbon pollution?
One of the more controversial answers to those questions is the early retirement of Colorado's coal plants, which could leave thousands without work in the very near future.
There are a handful of places where coal is very, very important to the local economy.
Will Tour is director of the Colorado Energy Office. He says there's a huge need for laws that help offset the impact of doing away with coal. One bill under consideration by Representative Chris Hansen would make it less expensive to pay off the costs of functioning coal plants that are being shut down.
He has built into that legislation an ability for a portion of those funds to be used directly for economic development and workforce transition in those affected communities.
Do you see that little Tesla thing up there?
Yeah.
Back in Longmont, Jerry Maritza is showing me a lesser-known feature hidden in the battery's logo.
Apparently, when we charge these things, that Tesla lights up red.
Maritza says that he's all for a transition to zero carbon. It makes good business sense. The batteries have already saved his company more than $1 million in operating costs. But right now, there's just no way to make that leap, which is why companies like United Power are picking dates so far out into the future.
Somebody sets these big goals and you're like, I'm the guy that actually has to like figure out how we're doing.
No, you summed it up perfectly. And notice also that they say 2050 because they know they're probably not going to be in office when that year shows up.
Maritza says he sees his role in the transition as a difficult but exciting challenge. He's already started planning another battery installation. Matt Bloom, KUNC, Longmont.
Okay, we're almost into May, and I think we're done with spring snowstorms. I don't want to jinx it, though.
Don't jinx it, Erin. Especially since there is a challenge going on from April 26th through the 29th across the country.
I'm going to guess it has something to do with being outdoors.
Exactly. You know me too well. Boulder, Denver, Colorado Springs, and Fort Collins are all taking part of what's called the City Nature Challenge, using an app called iNaturalist. I was able to get outdoors and talk with Angela Borland, the education specialist for Larimer County Natural Resources. She gave a little insight on what it is to be a naturalist and how this is a great activity to explore our Colorado backyard.
The idea of a naturalist is that we're finding information about everything, whether it's the plants, the animals, the birds, under the water, about the water, the geology. If it's in nature, that's what we're trying to observe. So as we're out, we're working on being new naturalists, being good observers, and really getting that chance to experience our natural areas in a different way.
Using iNaturalist is really easy. Download the app or go online, upload a picture of an animal, plant, insect, or whatever you find, note the location, and share it in the City Nature Challenge project in your city. You can find more information at citynaturechallenge.org.
We know lots of people enjoy visiting Colorado for the wildlife, and that's what makes this next story so fascinating because it affects many of those animals that we love to connect with.
There is a fatal disease affecting deer, elk, and moose all across the country. It starts with weight loss and ends with stumbling and drooling as the animal's brain tissue deteriorates. It's bad for them, and it could be bad for us. KUNC's Ray Ellen Bushell has been exploring chronic wasting disease, starting with the question, what exactly is it, and where did it come from?
We'll start in northern Colorado. This area is considered the epicenter of the now international animal epidemic.
They're right here somewhere.
Heather Swanson and Ryan Priereski monitor wildlife with the city of Boulder. They're standing in knee-high golden grass on a slope where the Rocky Mountains start slumping into the plains. The ecologists have their binoculars out, and they're watching a herd of mule deer.
Gosh, what's going on, little one?
A mule deer fawn is running circles around the rest of the herd. It has the boing of a muscular slinky toy.
Wired. It's just doing laps.
A few others are rearing up on their hind legs and kicking each other. The other animals are just hanging out in the shade. It looks like a beautiful spring morning, and the animals look healthy. But all is not what it seems.
So that is buck number 46. He is positive.
So is doe number 22.
She's positive as well. Doesn't show any symptoms. She looks perfectly fine.
Symptoms of chronic wasting disease. If there are any mountain lions around, though, they'd be able to tell. Swanson and her colleagues looked at that phenomenon in a study a few years ago.
And the mountain lions were definitely preferentially selecting deer that had chronic wasting disease over those that were negative. And for most of the ones that they had killed, we had not detected any chronic wasting disease symptoms yet.
Unlike us, the mountain lions know that while a deer might look sleek and alert, it's actually a ticking time bomb. That's one of the weird things about this disease. It isn't like the usual viral or bacterial illness. The infection can sit in a herd, crawling from animal to animal for years before people notice that anything is wrong.
And kind of through time degrades essentially their brain tissue.
That's when things can go downhill fast. Swanson says it could be a matter of weeks before that sleek, alert doe starts to droop and drool as the infection gnaws holes into its brain.
That seems to happen pretty rapidly, where to our eyes they look fairly healthy, and within a number of weeks they reach that point and then they're gone.
Lately, the media has been calling it zombie deer disease, and there are at least three bills being considered at the national level right now to fight the infection. A few weeks ago, Wyoming Senator John Barrasso got in front of a congressional hearing to introduce one of them.
Today I'm here to talk about a different kind of health crisis that's facing our nation.
He told lawmakers that the neurodegenerative disease is infecting deer, elk, and moose, and that it's been found in captive and wild animals in at least 26 states in the U.S. It's very contagious.
And always fatal.
He worries there's still a lot we don't know about the disease, including exactly how it spreads and whether it's a danger to humans. But we do know this.
Unchecked, this disease could truly be catastrophic for wildlife and for local economies.
On the same day that Barrasso was talking to his colleagues in Congress, an infectious disease specialist named Michael Osterholm was speaking to state lawmakers in Minnesota.
This is a kind of a worst-case nightmare.
And it's a nightmare that's hard to explain. See, chronic wasting disease is not your garden variety infectious disease. It's not bacterial, viral, or even fungal. Osterholm says it's caused by something called prions.
If Stephen King could write an infectious disease novel, he'd write it about prions.
They're just very different from traditional pathogens.
That's Caitlin Wagner. She studies prions at Colorado State University. She says the prions that cause chronic wasting disease start out as normal proteins. All mammals have them, sitting on the surfaces of our healthy cells. But the difference between a good prion and a very bad one is their shape. One way to think about it is origami.
Yeah, no, that's a perfect example.
Say healthy prion proteins are shaped like origami cranes. If an abnormal origami crane comes along with a bent wing, the normal origami cranes will copy it. One by one, their wings will bend too. When enough healthy proteins have been bent out of shape, those misshapen proteins can gather in clumps, killing off cells in the animal's body.
And that causes them to get sick.
It leaves the brain full of holes, like a sponge. And these prions don't just stop at the brain. They can end up all over the place, in urine, feces, blood, saliva. They can stick around in the environment, too, for decades. The disease is now showing up not only in the U.S., but also in three Canadian provinces, South Korea, Finland, even in Swedish moose and Norwegian reindeer. And it all started here, in the Mountain West. Or did it? Everything changed in the spring of 2016.
Hello.
Roy Anderson is a research technician with the Norwegian Institute for Nature Research. He and his colleagues monitor wild reindeer. The animals are big and fast and skittish, so the researchers don't mess around. They dart them with tranquilizers from the air.
We're shooting a dart gun from the helicopter, probably around 5 or 10 meters away from the animals.
On one spring day, Anderson and his colleagues were doing what they often do, blasting across a snowy plateau, chasing a herd of about 500 wild reindeer.
Everything is going really fast, of course. They're running quite fast.
The group's veterinarian was hanging out the side of the helicopter with a dart gun.
The vet, he shot first one dart. He missed on that one and then grabbed the second gun and shot another dart from that one. And he also missed on that dart, too. So that's when we have to stop.
They landed, and Anderson and the others got out to find the darts. The co-pilots were waiting by the helicopter when one of them spotted something.
He saw something down the hill about 200 meters away.
So Anderson went to take a look. It was a reindeer.
It was lying on his side, flat out. It's not very common for the reindeer. And it was like, had all these bubbles and stuff coming out of his mouth.
3 or 4 minutes later, the animal was dead. Anderson and his colleagues thought they'd killed it, that a dart had hit it in a weird way, or that it was just stressed out from the helicopter chase. They zipped it up in a giant duffel bag.
And we brought the animal with us down to the mountains to find out what had happened to it.
Samples from the sick reindeer eventually made their way over to the laboratory of Sylvie Benestad with the Norwegian Veterinary Institute.
And it was really strongly positive.
Positive for chronic wasting disease.
That started the problem.
She says Norway has some of the only wild reindeer in Europe. And if the disease spread to other reindeer, it could put an end to the tradition of reindeer herding there. Based on how quickly and viciously it spread in the U.S., the Norwegians knew they had to do something.
If we didn't do anything, it would be enormous consequences. So we felt that we had to react immediately.
They sent sharpshooters out in helicopters and snowmobiles to kill all the reindeer where the infection had been found. 2,400 of them.
Yes, it's a lot, yes.
And of those euthanized animals, 19 tested positive for the disease.
We still don't know how it came to Norway.
Norway has strict rules about importing live animals, so Benestad says the disease couldn't have arrived that way. One hypothesis was that it came from the U.S. way back in the 1930s when neighboring Finland imported a bunch of white-tailed deer to populate its forests. But that was so long ago, and there didn't seem to be any problem with Finnish deer. Maybe, Benestad says, it came from attractants made of deer pee, which hunters can find online. But then something else happened.
About 2 months after the first case in reindeer, we discovered 2 moose.
Again, Benestad analyzed the samples.
And I noticed immediately that it was something different.
This version of the disease was different from the one circulating in North America. In fact, upon closer inspection, the earlier samples from the 19 diseased reindeer were different too. And it didn't end there. Last year, a moose in Finland tested positive, way over by the Russian border, about 800 miles away. And this spring, the illness showed up in Sweden. A hunter came across a moose that was in bad shape, thin, confused, walking in circles.
The hunter thought that perhaps it was blind.
That's Maria Normark. She's an epidemiologist with the National Veterinary Institute in Sweden.
And that was the first case we have detected in Sweden.
It's worth mentioning something important, though.
Our one was 16. Years old, so she was old.
Other cases in moose have also happened in older animals, and the infection shows up in fewer places in the body than the disease does in deer and reindeer. It also seems to be a lot less contagious. Scientists are trying to figure out what all this means. Could there be 3 different kinds of chronic wasting disease? And where are they all coming from, anyway? For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Ray Ellen Bichelle.
Next week, we follow up on those questions with research from a couple of scientists trying to figure out where the disease started and whether it could spread to humans. And if you can't wait until then, you can find all the stories in our Bent Out of Shape series at KUNC.org.
Once upon a time, a long time ago, many Americans went to the movies 3 times a week to be mesmerized by the dazzling light bouncing off huge movie screens. KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz teaches film and television at CU Denver. He says we're losing too much as our screens grow smaller.
A few weeks ago, I did a report for NPR on a film that came and went in these parts in just a week. It's an astonishing movie from the Chinese director Jia Zhongke called Ash is Purest White. It takes place over 17 years in the lives of two people in the low-level criminal underworld of China. Xiao, the woman, swaggers with arrogance through a disco and mahjong club, while Bin Ke, her guy, lords it over other low-rent crooks. It's temporary. For the director, Ash's Purest White is about how the sudden economic expansion in China has obliterated things like personal codes of honor and loyalty, and also actual physical proofs of China's ancient culture. Xiao rides on a ferry on the lake made by the infamous Three Gorges Dam, which has inundated villages 2,000 years old. I didn't see Ash's Purest White at a festival, so I had to watch it on a computer screen by way of a link, which has become too common in the past 2 or 3 years. My editor and I did the report, which I think came out pretty well. I generally figure that I have enough experience to compensate when I have to watch a film on a smaller screen than the filmmaker intended. Then I had the chance to see Ash's Purest White on an actual movie screen, and I realized that while I didn't misunderstand the movie, I would have understood it better, richer, and a bit differently if I'd seen it big right off the bat. One of the things the film's getting at is how Chinese society is in a big rush, but the question is to where? And there it was, right on that big screen, expansive shots of a Chinese bullet train zipping across huge, barren landscapes and never coming to a stop in a station. These are magnificent images of a country able to move at tremendous speeds, but clueless about the question of direction. And seeing Ash's Purest White small is really seeing the movie diminished. You lose the same sense of scale if you watch a John Ford Western on a laptop, or worse, a phone. Ford made long shots of stagecoaches and horsemen riding across Monument Valley to show how puny human beings can be in the immensity of nature. You simply can't see that on little screens. You may get the idea, but you won't feel your innards sizzling at the sight. The recent Icelandic film A Woman at War, about a woman taking down high-tension power lines in wilderness areas, is one thing on your laptop, but it's an experience of another dimension seen big, when the sheer size of Iceland's tundra takes over your entire field of vision. And when a band of musicians suddenly appears on the landscape, on a big screen you feel fully the delicious absurdity. My film classes take place in a theater, and over students say that they're surprised at how it changes a movie to see it big when they'd only seen it small before. More and more, we seem to prefer staying in the comfort of home, and frankly, the movie theater experience has been fouled by texting, talking, and rudeness. But staying at home, you lose the fascinating experience of the outside world, the surprises that come from leaving the familiarity of home. And in the movies, we lose both community and the sense, the possibility of grandeur, the chance to see something that could inspire awe. In 1919, the city of Toledo, Ohio, had a population of about 250,000. And for those people, there were about 55,000 movie theater seats, because there was something big and impressive to see. By that measure, Colorado should have 1.25 million seats, which it does not. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
This has been Colorado Edition, made possible with support from our KUNC members. If you enjoy listening and you're not a member, you can support our work with a contribution in any amount at KUNC.org.
And if you do it before the end of the first day of our spring membership drive, which is Monday, April 29th, your gift will be doubled. You've been meaning to donate, so why not do it right now? Our show this week was produced by me, Erin O'Toole.
And me, Carly Huckles. News director Catherine Welch contributed to our show, along with editors Brian Larson and Jackie High, who manages digital.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Kalatana. We also heard fellow Colorado artist Robbie Reverb with Bling Bong.
Other music in this episode was provided by Blue Dot Sessions. If you like what you're hearing, make sure you don't miss an episode.
Subscribe to Colorado Edition at KUNC.org or wherever you listen to podcasts.
And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC. See.